You remember at the start I was saying that Fernie Hill's newest song is 1995. I think Are You Washed in the Blood is actually one of our newest ones, actually. It's always good to go back and sing some of those ones again, songs that you get brought up with. So I've been asked to come and share a little bit of, I guess it's my story, the impact that Jesus has made. And it's always difficult to know just what bits of your story you should share. I mean, I'm getting senior now, apparently. According to my kids, I'm getting senior anyway. One of them told me today I was really old. I was a bit shocked at that. I've always lived in the perception that I'm still really young, but when a five-year-old tells you you're really old, you're really old. But I guess I need to talk to you something about some of my past to help you understand the journey that God has taken me on. And so I guess I'll just start near the start and work our way through it. And I promise I won't take too long. But I also want you to get, I don't want to get the sense that I'm glorifying anything of the past. Before Jesus touched my life, there was lots of it that was, well, there was some of it that was supposedly fun at the time, but it only left a bitter taste in the mouth. And I guess my story is one of, it's one of a bitter teenager, I suppose, that God dealt with in an incredible way. But I guess it's what made that bitterness that is really a huge part of my story. So I grew up in a very, very strict Christian home. We were part of the movement that's known as the Closed Brethren Movement, and it was intense, it was scary. However, I had a father and a mother who had been saved out of quite dramatic circumstances. My mum only became a Christian when she was, I think she was only about 20, she must have only been about 26 when she became a Christian. My dad was about 32. But in that environment, when you grow up in that kind of strict environment, your personality can be quashed somewhat, especially if you're loud, like, unfortunately, I was and am. I'm a little bit loud, and I get carried away. And it can be difficult in those environments when people want you to behave in a certain way. So everything I would say, though, there was a lot of love in our house. My dad was a very affectionate man, just an amazing guy. And his story and my story are very wrapped up in each other, to be honest. But everything was good. Kind of just rumbled along in life. Life was okay. Church was okay. You know, there was some good folk there. I had some good friends at church. There's elements of it that I enjoyed. I loved going to Sunday school. But in the Closed Brethren, you go to church three times on a Sunday. You go on a Monday night. You go on a Tuesday night. You go on a Wednesday night. And you go on a Friday. And then you do fellowship meetings on a Saturday. So the only day you really have was the Thursday. Was for yourself, but you weren't allowed to go out and meet with non-Christians in that environment, so you really just spent a lot of your time around your parents, so you actually have to learn to love them, and your siblings, you have to really learn to love them. But at 8, everything changed. There was, the moment that would have defined my whole life, it changes you, some of it for the better, some of it for the worse. So at the beginning of 1988, so there you are, you know how old I am. My mum was diagnosed just after my little sister was born. My mum was diagnosed with leukemia. Now, my mum was only 34 at this point. And as an 8-year-old, you know that your mum's ill. So you just assume that doctor's going to give her a pill and everything's going to be okay. But unfortunately for our family, that wasn't the case. 10 weeks after her being diagnosed, she died. And that left my dad, a widow at 40, with 4 young kids. My eldest sister was 14, my brother was 10, I was 8, and my little sister was 2. So when you look at that as an environment when you've grown up in a really sheltered environment, when something rocks your world like that, my mum was a real protector in the home. My dad had, although he was loving, he had a temper. I'm sure all of us have a temper that we could testify to, but he had a real temper. And so everything changes from that moment. Your kind of life either stops there or starts there. And for me at 8 years old, my life kind of started, but it wasn't down the right track. So where my brother went off on a track and used what had happened to become so determined to achieve, I used what had happened to behave in the worst possible way I could, because I knew that people would cut me a bit of slack because of what had happened. So at 8 years old, we moved up to Scotland as a family just to escape the past. And my dad decided to move to Scotland and try and start a new business, which actually is still going, unbelievably, how God has honoured him in that business all these years. It's a long time we've been in Scotland then. And we were still caught up, though, in this really strict religious environment. So I genuinely could not see how God could have allowed these circumstances to happen. How can you remove a 34-year-old woman from a family who need her? And that would have been where my questioning really started of God. I grew to completely distrust God, distrust Christians. In fact, I would say, by the time I was 17, I actually hated Christians. I really did. I had no time for them whatsoever. And that's due to a variety of things. But what happened during those 8 through 17, and I'm not going to take too long to talk about this, but these are the real moments. So my dad, who'd been a heavy drinker in the RAF, had become a Christian and had stopped drinking. After my mum passed away, he started drinking heavily. Now, you combine that with a vicious temper, and it sets for a real volatile situation. My sister got married at 17. She left home before it all kicked in. My brother moved away at university, so it left me with my younger sister. And my dad remarried also 3 years later to the most amazing woman, I have to say. One of the most amazing women I have ever met. Godly, and I couldn't have asked for a better stepmother. I have to say, I'm not one of these ones that sees my stepmother as being a wicked stepmother that came in. She was truly an amazing woman. She really was, and I was thankful to God in some ways, well, I am now, that God sent her. But all this stuff is going on. In a sheltered Christian environment, we left the Close Brethren and went to a wonderful church, Church of Scotland out in Pencaitland, where we spent 9 years out there, which was, again, amazing how God, again, I'll show you how God ordained all that, how he had planned all that for us, because there were truly fantastic Christians out that way that I eventually began to know. But all this stuff is going on in the home. So Dad is arriving home very, very drunk, very, very angry, almost every night of the week. And that went on from age 10 through till about when I was about 17. He was never physically abusive, but he was verbally incredibly abusive, and particularly to me. I think he saw me as one of the macho challengers in the house, although where he got that from, I don't know. But he certainly vented an awful lot of it out on me and said things that would, I would say maybe even today, still have knock-on effects of things. So he would blame me for my mum's death. He would really attack my character on huge levels about my loudness, about my sense of humor, about my ego and things like that. And he would just really attack me over almost every dinner table, to the point where it almost got to physical stuff between the two of us until I took myself away. Combine that with the fact that at 11 years old, though, I had discovered alcohol for myself. So grew up in a really sheltered home, and I got drunk for the first time at 11, and I loved it. So you've got two alcohol abusers in the same house. I'm not saying I loved it because of the substance. I loved what it did. It just completely masked the pain, for me. It made me forget for hours. I really liked ladies, but fortunately, they didn't like me. So I didn't get any bother that way, but I thought the alcohol basically gave me license to chat up every girl that ever crossed my path. And thankfully, God just made me ugly, so it didn't really cause any problems there. But I just had this huge area of confidence under alcohol, and that went on, really, 11 through to 17. When I was 15, fell in with a group of guys at college. I left school when I was 15, pretty much asked to leave school at 15, to be honest with you. I was too young to leave. I shouldn't have left, but I did, and I was a young boy in an adult world, and discovered cannabis, and probably used cannabis every day from 15 through to almost the end of my 17th year. And I was in a mess. I was in a real mess. You know, I think I was psychologically damaged from these kinds of things. When you start drinking at that kind of age, it does, especially when you're from a sheltered environment, I think it does strange things to you. And you don't think about consequences. So I never, ever thought about consequences at all. I had decided that I was going to party my way through life, meet as many girls as possible, drive fast motorbikes, drive fast cars, and I had no real concept for anybody other than me. Nothing. Nobody else mattered. And I often think, like, what I put my stepmom through at that time. She was 40 when she married my dad. She'd never had any of her own kids. And she had to try and hold this alcoholic father with this nutcase of a son somehow. She had to hold the whole thing together, which she did remarkably, under the guidance of God, which I can see now. So that's where we were at. At 17, I had decided that was my life. So I wasn't really looking to become a Christian. But then, as was so often the case, there was this girl. So there was this girl in the village in Pencaitland who I asked out on numerous occasions. And she kept on saying no. I just couldn't understand it. Like, why would she say no to me? And it turns out she was a Christian. And she said, this guy moved into the village who was like, I am English, okay? I know it might not sound like I'm English, but I'm English and I'm proud to be English. But this guy was really English. Like, he was, like, really posh English. And I didn't like him. I knew he was a Christian. And, I just couldn't stand the sight of him, to be honest. But he found out that I liked this girl, so he decided that me, along with a couple of the group of lads that were all causing trouble at the time, he was going to do a Youth Alpha course for us. And I was like, I'm not going to your Youth Alpha course. And he said, Catherine's coming. I says, I am going to your Youth Alpha course. And I spent the next 10 weeks going to this Youth Alpha course trying to chat up Catherine. However, during that time, I was really into drama when I was a kid as well. I wanted to be a musical star and all that kind of stuff. I just loved that kind of stuff. And he knew that. And so he decided that we were going to put on a drama for the church at the end. And I thought, anything to have the limelight. And I said, I'll do it so long as I get a really important role in it and you can put me up front. But the song that was played was a song by a guy called Carmen. I don't know if you've heard, Carmen's a nutcase, cheesy guy from America, but I love him now because a lot of folk don't like him, but I think he's amazing. But the song was all about, this blood is for you. It was about the crucifixion, about everything that Jesus had done was for me. And I had to play this song over and over to learn the drama that we were doing. We were kind of miming a drama onto it. And I don't think I have ever been more moved by a song in my life. But that week, there was no doubt in my mind, no matter how much I tried to deny it, God was speaking directly to me. Paul, this blood is for you. What Jesus is doing on the cross is for you. And I kept, no, I do not want to hear that. I do not want to have anything to do with that stuff. I hate Christians. I hate church. I hate all this stuff. But it's for you, Paul. This is for you. And it just kept on running through. And on the night we were due to do the performance, everything went really well. And I still couldn't shake this thought. There's still lots of turmoil going on at home. In terms of the fact that me and my dad weren't talking, even though he'd been through rehab and was sober by this point, and he's still sober today, that's 17, 18 years on almost, our relationship was just still at loggerheads because of the way I was behaving. But Nick Blair, who was the worker at Fernie Hill, which is where I'm now working, was the youth worker at Fernie Hill, had come out to speak at Pencaitland randomly, had broken down twice on the way, didn't know why he was meant to be there. It was pouring with rain on the night, and I've spoken to Nick since about that night, and he went away thinking, what was the point in me being there? But the point in him being there was that he delivered just this really simple message. It was actually a joke that he told, the one about somebody hanging off a cliff saying, God, if you're there, catch me or something, or help me. And God says, let go and I'll catch you. And is there anybody else there? Is the sort of reply. And I thought, something about that that's just needling the back of my head. That's exactly what I'm doing. I'm trying to find help in all these things. I'm trying to find answers in all these things. And all through this week, all through this Alpha course, God's saying, I'm here. Just let go of all that stuff and I will catch you. And I'm still going, but no, there must be something else. But I remember at the end of that service, as Nick prayed, and he just basically said, you know, you need to make a decision. And he didn't know me from Adam. He didn't know who I was. But I remember sitting in the pew going, I can't actually believe this. And it's a bit like a C.S. Lewis conversion. It was a reluctant conversion. Because I wanted to party. I wanted to take drugs. I wanted to drink. That because I hadn't really seen the major effects of it yet. But I remember thinking, if I don't make this decision to follow Christ, my life is never going to be good. It is never going to go well for me. And I thought, I have to make this. There is nothing else for me to do. I have to make this choice to become a Christian. And so I did, and my best friend became a Christian that night. And he's since kind of fallen away from his faith. But that was in 1997, October 17th, 1997. And everything's been amazing since? No, not quite. But God has done amazing things through that. At the end of that year, I went to work for Bethany, and I worked for Bethany Christian Trust for 14 years, working where God moved every day. It was really a profound experience as an 18-year-old to be in amongst these guys who, I mean, got to remember, I didn't like alcoholics, I didn't like addicts, and yet God placed me right in the middle of them all at Bethany. I worked in the rehab for 12 of my 14 years at Bethany, working with these amazing guys, amazing characters. And when you see somebody from that environment become a Christian, it's just amazing. It's an awesome thing to experience God at work. And God slowly repaired all these relationships between me and my dad. We locked things back up again, and I don't think we'll ever be fantastically close. Sometimes too much water's gone on, but you know, there's a genuine affection and love for each other now that's there. There's trust back in that relationship again now. And I would say, so that's 17 years I spent not being a Christian, and now I've spent, this will be 18 years this year, being a Christian. And one of the things that I've come to realize is, and it was the life of Joseph really that had a profound effect on me, where at the end of his life, he was able to say, what you meant for evil, God meant for good. And I remember thinking about that verse, because I was still bitter as a Christian about what God had allowed to happen. You know, for the first 2 years of my Christian walk, I was still very bitter. I still could not understand why God would have allowed those things to happen. But slowly I began to understand that, you know, I'm not saying that I suffered like Joseph, and I'm not saying that I've suffered as much as anybody in this room. I mean, there'll be many of you that have suffered far greater than I have. But I guess that's not the point, is it? It's not about who suffers most. It's about how you deal with your circumstances and what you allow God to take you through. But I genuinely became to trust that God had allowed my mum to die for good. Romans 8:28, we know in all things God works for the good of those who love him. Those kind of verses really started to have huge effect on me, because I began to see that my experiences of bereavement, and I lost lots of friends along the way as well. You know, and a young friend of mine was killed in a motorbike accident. Another of my friends committed suicide. So in all these years, I experienced a lot of bereavement. And then, you know, my stepmom was actually taken when she was only 60 from an 8-week battle with cancer. So it just seems like bereavement has followed me, but I have learned to really genuinely trust that God can carry you through it. But I guess the last thing I want to share with you is, sometimes when you become a Christian, there can be this aspect that you think everything's going to be okay. And I suppose for me, I did think that I'd made that commitment and everything was going to be fine. I got married really young. I got married when I was 22. I had our first child when I was 25. And then a year after Caris came along, that's my eldest, I can only describe it as having a mental breakdown. So I guess for me, I like to be considered to be really strong. I like to be considered to having everything in complete control. And even my relationship with God, I want to have control of that. And for 8 years, God worked through these things with me. But because I wasn't listening, I was allowed to go through probably the most torturous 3 years of my life, where I was utterly, utterly depressed. You know, thoughts of self-harm, thoughts of just horrendous low self-esteem. I couldn't leave the house. If I did leave the house, I would plan how I was going to be when I was at church, because I thought nobody liked me. And I know it sounds like you get caught up in pity, but I genuinely thought, like, why would people want to spend time with me? Because I was so loud. And every time I would go into a room, I would think, I wonder what they're saying about me now that I've left it. And I just got to the point where I just could not function outside of the house. And so I just locked myself up. And everything, like, from the perspective of somebody looking in, they should have said that he's got a good job, he's got a lovely wife, he's got great kids. And even my family said that to me, you know, just pull yourself together, get a grip. You know, stop taking your medication and just get a grip. It's really, honestly, it was definitely the hardest 3 years of my life, as God worked through that kind of aspect with me. And I was on antidepressants for those 3 or 4 years. Really on, I would say, on the edge of completely losing it. That's how it felt for me. And God incredibly incredibly brought me through that period and really allowed me to trust him more. But I guess one of the things is that I wanted to really share with you about that was that I had, one of the things my dad used to say to me when he was drunk was, do you know what people say when they see you coming, Paul? They all say, oh, here we go, here's big mouth again, here's loud mouth. And that, it's amazing that that word at 8 years old, how that just, that used to play around in my mind. Every time I was out, I used to hear that. And I used to think to myself, so I used to plan my night out and I would go, right, I'm just going to sit in the corner and I'm going to be quiet. And I'm not going to say anything, and it'll all be nice. I'll just let conversation pass me by. But see, when you're trying to suppress, my naturalness is not like that. I like to be big and bold, and I like... It's not that I like to be center of attention, but I just... I am loud, and I can't do anything about that. It's just part of who I am. And I got this text message towards the end of the depression. I'd been away on a weekend with some guys from church, and I come away, and I said to Joanne, that's it. I cannot do church anymore. These guys are all talking about me now. I know they're talking about me because I was so loud on the night. I was just, I could hear myself and I'm thinking, oh, what am I doing? And then this guy, who's not touchy-feely at all in a sense, he'd barely hug you, let alone, he sent me this text message. And like, I've said this to him since there, that it was like God was speaking to me. And he didn't know what I was going through because I'd kept it fairly quiet about what I was going through. And it said, Paul, I just want you to know that I've really enjoyed your company this week. He said, and particularly how loud you laugh. And I honestly couldn't believe it. It was like God had just sent this message to me. And I think from that moment on, something switched in me that I realized, listen, you don't need to fear what people think about you. It can be a really lonely place if you go out. So there'll be the odd time where I do get caught up in that and get held back by it. But I think depression is such a common thing, isn't it, that we don't know what the people next to us have been through. And I think sometimes we can not realize that some of the bubbliest people have often been through that. And for me, one of the reasons why I asked for that song, Blessed Be Your Name, is that I have come to really know that in my life, that God gives and God takes away. But if you stop there, you've only got half the picture. If you can learn to say, Blessed Be Your Name, then you've learned the lesson, I think, that God wants you to know. Before I came to work at Ferniehill, I thought I'd been disqualified from ministry because of my depression. I thought, you know, I can never go and work for a church. That's something, even though I'd wanted to do that for a long time, I thought, that's never going to be allowed to happen now. But, and I also believed that the gifts had ceased. That was my upbringing, and I believed that the gifts didn't cease. And then I met a friend of mine who said, Paul, you're so stuffy. You're so, like, caught up in your own knowledge and your own ego that you need to really do something about that and let God soften your heart. And that's been the last bit of my journey, I suppose. And I'll finish with this, that to go from a closed bedroom background like I had, where the Holy Spirit didn't move unless through a preacher, to a night 6 years ago in my living room when a friend of mine, Cameron Black, came out. I don't know if anybody knows Cameron Black, but he's one of the most awesome Christians I've ever met. And me and him had been arguing about how the Spirit moved. And I had said, you know, it doesn't move like that anymore. He'll never move like that in my life. And he's like, well, you let me come and pray for you, and then we'll decide how the Spirit moves. And I remember just being completely flaked out on the floor of my living room, speaking in tongues, going, I cannot believe this has just happened to me. This is absolutely ridiculous. But I can tell you that since that moment, I have come to realize that if you rely, like I had done for so many years as a Christian, on your own self-sense of importance or on how you think it works, it's never truly fulfilling. And from that moment on, I would say I've learned, like the Apostle Paul says, for me, living is about living for Jesus. Dying is even better. Not that I want to die, not that I want to be away from it all, but I've learned that really living for Jesus is allowing his Holy Spirit to impact me on a daily basis. And that really has been my story. Do I have ups and downs? I do have ups and downs, yeah. But thankfully, God has really done a huge amount of healing over the depression over the years. And really, I've come to realize that it's nothing of myself. As hard as that has been for somebody with an ego to admit, that it is actually surrendering to the Holy Spirit and saying, listen, I'm going to allow you to move. I'm going to allow you to do something with my life rather than me deciding. That's me. We've got a song to sing, haven't we?